She threw away her religion years before when it stopped working. But now it was a time of great testing and she needed it, and she didn't know what to do, so she called me. Marjorie Mann claimed that she was dying. Her doctors concurred, and it wasn't the first time that she had been told. But this time, she was sure that they were right. She could feel the void in front of her, and she didn't have the strength to rally. But dying, of course, meant finding some reconciliation with some of the things with which she had become estranged. "It's religion," she said to me. "For a long time, I was Presbyterian, but now I don't know what to believe." She apologized over and over. "I probably shouldn't think this way," she said. I shouldn't take up your time." The number of shouldn'ts told me how much she was struggling. "I don't think Jesus came down from the clouds and performed miracles," she said, "or that his suffering saved us. I think Jesus was a real person, a real human being who tried to teach us how to live and how to love. And I think that's all he was." "And God?" she said, staring into space. "I know I shouldn't be saying this, but I'm not sure what to think about God." So she told me the story of her life, the stuff of broken hearts and broken promises, about her father who she adored, who died when she was still a little girl, and about her first husband who died in an automobile accident only a year after their marriage, and her second husband who died while still young from a brain tumor, and her third husband, younger than she, who died before her. And she described her whole life as yearning for a reliable love capable of saving her that never quite showed up, at least for long. And she didn't understand why we were made to feel this deep yearning that couldn't quite ever be fulfilled. And then she asked again, "What is God?" How many people can understand questions like these? How many people grew up going to church? How many people grew up going to a Christian church? How many people grew up knowing all of the practices and rituals about when to kneel and what to say and all of that kind of stuff? And how many people still ran across things that didn't make sense? There's a story of a pastor who one morning told the children's story in front of the congregation, and he started out by saying, "Now I'm going to describe something, and I want you to raise your hand when you think you know what I'm describing." And all of the children nodded eagerly, and he began, "Well, this thing lives in trees, and it's gray, and it's fuzzy, and it looks far and wide for all the nuts that it can find, and then it gathers all those nuts together and stores together as many as it can find." And finally, one boy excitedly raised his hand, but then he was a little hesitant. So the pastor encouraged him. He says, "Wes, what do you think it is?" And the boy said, "Well," and spoke sheepishly, he says, "I know the answer is Jesus, but it sure sounds like a squirrel to me." How many people have had that kind of experience with religion before? Sometimes feeling carefully led to things that just didn't quite make sense. And although people you admired and trusted talked about love, there was always something a little squirrely behind some of what came out. For how many people was hypocrisy part of that struggle? And so you quit. One day just opened the door, took the whole thing, threw it out, walked away, didn't look back. And when you finally found your way back to a place like this, you knew that you wanted and you needed it to be fundamentally different. What we experienced is not new. All religions, in fact, all social movements that work to try and create more love in the world encounter this same process of being imperfect. Take, for example, the early days when Christianity was forming, and I want to talk a little bit about Paul, and I'll parenthetically say that I really never thought in my entire career I would preach about Paul. I have sort of a love-hate relationship with Paul. I really don't like many of the things that Paul said. Things that he said were about discrimination of women or against gays and lesbians or against sex in general, since he was a rather prudish kind of fellow. And especially his theology, which I believe exploited Jesus' life and ignored key tenets that Jesus was trying to teach, especially where Jesus asked people to love one another even and especially when they were different, or asked people to forgive and be kind to one another, not just their friends, but their enemies. And especially when Jesus talked about heaven and said that it's not something that's waiting for you in the by and by in the clouds, it's something that's already in you, something that already moves through you, if you choose to see it. But Paul focused instead to talk more about believing in Jesus as the one and only gateway to salvation. And I could never quite make sense of that stance that said that millions of people will go to hell for being raised a Buddhist or Hindu or having no religion at all, for that matter. And so at some point, I gathered it all up and threw it all out the back door. But years afterwards, there came a time where I felt something was missing. And what was missing for me was a deep sense of belonging that I felt was a birthright and a sense of connection that I was certain of, and love being at the heart of that connection. But it was that same love that hadn't always been as reliable as I would have liked it in my life. And so I ended up going to seminary and began a real conversation about love and about Christianity and about Paul. And I learned a few things that I didn't know. I learned that, for starters, Jesus didn't start Christianity. Paul started Christianity. Jesus never wanted to start a new religion. Jesus was a Jew. He wanted to reform his Judaism. It was Jesus who emphasized the sense of connection and interdependence and breaking down the prejudice and rigidity that kept people divided. It was Paul who was more the rule-oriented person, the organizer who started the religion, and it was he and his disciples who spread Christianity, and they did so by using two central practices which I had not really known about before. The first central practice that Paul and a lot of the originators of Christianity used was the agape love feast. And this was a meal that they invited everyone in the community to sit down together at the same table. And these were people who had fundamental differences with one another. So he invited men and women to sit together. He invited Jew and Gentile. He invited rich and poor, slave and master, even gay and lesbian and heterosexual, all sitting together to understand that there were many more things that unified them, like love and justice, than were different. And the other thing that these fledgling original communities did is they followed out a tenet most commonly spoken by South American liberation theologian Gustavo Gutierrez, who in the 1960s described as a preferential option for the poor. Because at the time of Jesus and his followers and starting this religion, the Mesopotamia cultures were filled with an inordinate number of women who were widows and children who were orphans and strangers who did not have a home or a place to go. And these first fledgling communities created places that brought them in, gave them places to live, gave them food, gave them company and community, gave them education, which of course they taught Christianity. And it was through this that these early Christian communities grew from 12 at the time of Jesus' death to 90% of the Roman Empire within 300 years. That's amazing growth. Why does anything grow that much? Because it's desperately needed in the community. And that was because of Paul. Throughout Paul's life, he grew communities that made room at the table for everyone. When one community that he started was up and growing, he would move on to start another one. But over and over, after he left, the communities that were strong when he left would start to bicker, and old prejudices and rigidity would reemerge. And they always wrote to Paul and asked for advice, and Paul tried to write back and tried to unite them in their divisions. And where he was successful in doing this, he used love to try and hold them together. Where he failed, he often used rules and righteousness to try and unite them. Paul lived a very difficult life. The communities he started and loved and gave his life to were constantly fighting. And the love he tried to spread didn't always return back to him. The good he did often went unheralded, and his imperfections were magnified. Indeed, he spent much of the latter part of his life in prison, often scapegoated by local governments or because he inadvertently offended one of the factions of the community who turned against him and had enough power to put him in prison. In fact, Paul died in prison. More than most people, I think Paul would have understood how hard it is to devote your life to love after you recognize that love had the capacity to betray you and break your heart. It was his tenacious commitment and recommitment to building communities that promised love that I really grew in awe of. Paul had a unique way of approaching this. When he moved into a new community, he set up his trade. He was a tradesman, and he talked to people as they came into his shop, and he invited them, after they did their business, to gather together in the evenings, and when they came, he invited them to come back to eat together and to do benevolent projects together for the community. Paul's trade was tent maker. More precisely, Paul was a leather worker. He would take the dried-out, coarse pieces of leather. He would stretch them out. He would smooth out the roughness within each piece, and then he would sew those individual pieces together in a patchwork way, and then he would place pillars in the ground at key places and stretch again that sewn-together patchwork quilt of leather over those pillars, and he would make sure that the tents were large enough for more than just the people who were already there, but for the orphans and the widows and the strangers. That's what I have always wanted from a community. People who would stretch me. People who would smooth out some of my rough spots. Give me a place where I could become sewn into the lives of the people around me. A place where I could fasten myself to things that were deeply rooted, principles like love and justice. And places where all of us together could provide one another shelter, and not just for us, but for the people we know needed us, the lost and the lonely and the orphaned and the widowed. And most of all, I wanted a community that was committed to teaching me about love, and especially teach me about love after my heart had been broken, because that's when I needed it the most. I don't believe much of what Paul believed. In fact, I believe that much of what Paul believed has been carried forward and has been reinforced in the misogyny and the homophobia and the general division among people. He was a very imperfect leader. And I believe the Christianity he promoted often puts more emphasis on proselytizing and saving people than on loving them. And I know people are thinking of Jesus when they follow such practices, but it sure sounds squirrely to me. And I believe that not only are people not saved by this, but that we don't need saving. Indeed, I believe that quite a few are lost in the process, and there are more being lost every day. But when I went out in search of that belonging and that connection and that love that I felt was my birthright, it forced me to have a conversation and re-examine the prejudice and the rigidity that I had developed and all the lines that I had drawn in the sand. And I opened up my back door and discovered that rusty tub and that old man waiting for me to return. And the conversation we had was about love and how much we needed it and deserve it, and about how tender and sometimes painful it is to keep opening ourselves up to it even after we've been let down, and how much courage it takes to trust your heart after it has been broken, how much easier it is to draw lines in the sand and separate and protect yourself. But it's impossible to be happy living our lives that way, thinking in terms of division, but yearning for connection. We'll never be saved that way. And like I said, I don't think that we need saving. I believe that the love that we are looking for is not outside of us, but it's already in us, in each of us, and it comes to us, as Antonio Machado explains, like a blessed illusion, prompting us in our dreams, requiring us to stretch, to sew ourselves into one another, to tether ourselves to deeper foundations of truth, and to shelter each other in acceptance and love. When Marjorie lay before me and looked up at me and asked me, "What is God?" This is what I said. I bent down close to her, and I put her hand on my heart, and I took my hand and put it on her heart. And I said, "See? See how I can feel your heart and you can feel mine. See how I can understand your hurts and pain and hopes and you can understand mine. Can you feel a different kind of connection when we do this?" And she nodded. That's God. It's just the love that flows back and forth between people that often goes unnamed and unseen and unremembered, but that is God, and God is love, and that's all there is to it. And Jesus was just someone gathering up nuts and showing them that love was real. I didn't actually say the nuts part. I left that day and went back over the next week, couple weeks, and couple months to check on Marjorie. And ironically, she rallied and she lived for another 10 months. And the doctors and the nurses were all mystified. And some began to even call it a miracle. But I don't think it was the doctors that saved her or the hospital, and certainly not me. In fact, I don't think she needed saving. But it was the love in her life that was learning to come back and live and invite others. But in my mind, that wasn't the real miracle. The real miracle was that when she did die, she was not alone. She was surrounded by her friends and her family, many of whom she had been estranged with only a few months before. The miracle, I believe, was how far she was willing to go for love. and how much she was willing to travel to see the glory of life.